Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Dave Collum, thank you so much for being back with us and all our listeners here today.
Hey, it's great to be here. This is a tradition that I look forward to immensely.
Oh, me too. And hey, I'm just wondering, based on something you wrote in this year's review, do we need to start with a trigger warning here for any listeners? Maybe remind them that their computer has an off button if they choose?
Well, you know, I can keep it clean on a podcast. So it's up to them. I mean, if you take me in a direction that I hammer someone, as I actually said in the review, it said, you know, this is about humor and sarcasm. Someone's got to get hurt. It might be your turn.
Well, you know, what caught me right up front in part one is, because this comes in two parts, of course, was the Limerick King, who, you know, we follow each other on Twitter, really like the guy. And he started with, there was a med chemist named Dave. His year in review is the rave. With Epstein and Powell in repos most foul, his comments are sure to be grave. That's a good little Limerick.
Yeah, I solicit those. I tell the Limerick King what I'm going to talk about, you know, what's in it. And then I said, just whip out a limerick for me. And then most years I have Jeff Mackey of CNBC fame whip out some art. But his life is remarkably full. And so I actually have my wife do that. So I tend to open with a limerick and a Mackey original. But you got a Candace E. Cornell original this time.
Fantastic. You know, as I was reading through this, it really feels like this year in review has a very different flavor from the prior ones. And I'm wondering if you'd be willing to talk about that.
Yeah. You know, it's when I write this thing, I go real deep lizard brain on this. And as I actually spend more time at the opening describing where it comes from and how I write it, I actually give an autobiography. So there's always an about the author part, but I go deeper. I go back to when I was 12 years old. It's only a page. So, you know, and it is funny. But I kind of explain myself in part because of the feel that it was different. So this year I wrote it. And I wrote it in order of importance. And so I picked the section I thought was most important, the one I had to write. And then I picked the second one and the third one. And when I got to the end, and you know, you can't write a year in review in May, right? And so I have to write it all at once. And I bang out, I think this one's 147 pages, right? And so this is, you know, I'm kind of rewriting at the rate of William F. Buckley at this point. And I got to the end and I looked at it and I go, holy cow, the entire thing is about social change. And one of the things that's omitted, and I don't even know if people will be disappointed or happy, but there's not much finance actually. And one of the reasons is because it feels like we're at the top of something and it feels like we're on the cusp of something. And even if we're not, I mean, it's just getting crazier. And to document it, getting crazier just somehow didn't make sense to me this year. So, you know, there were stupid IPOs and dumb debt and all sorts of stuff, but that's been getting crazier and crazier. At some point, you just have to say, okay, look, this is the pregame. I'm not going to pay attention until the game starts. And so I've got reams of notes and I sorted them. And then I said, look, I'm not going to write about this stuff this year. Or I just didn't get to it as my priority. I don't write about Trump because everyone on the planet's writing about Trump and impeachments and stuff like that. And so I went for the things that I'd spent a lot of time. So the thing that absolutely, you know, passed like a kidney stone for me was literally 32 pages on climate change. The second part I wrote was on Epstein, which I think is far more profound than people are giving it credit. And then I go back to share buybacks because people are still missing them. That's kind of finance. But my conclusion goes very dark because I part of it's unsupported in the sense that I go dark in ways. You go, well, you didn't write about that. And I go, yeah, but it's on the cutting room floor and it bugged the crap out of me. And I think we're heading for a strange future here. And so as you mentioned in our pregame discussion, you know, it's kind of a fourth turning feel to me.
Mm-hmm. And this is the what I really want to focus on, because this has been, well, central in my thoughts and heart as well, is that listen, bubbles always get crazy towards the end, right? You know, and there are those, like, I have this bad habit of detecting bubbles really early and missing out on a lot of the fun, you know, and because I'm more of a fundamentalist. And it always amazes me that how much longer they can go on than seems normal, right? So the housing bubble, I was shorting very painfully to housing stocks in 2007. It took a while before they, you know, turned around, and mortgage insurers and all that. But even here, this is the third bubble in a row, but it's more extreme. It's everywhere. And they're doing whatever it takes to keep it going and all of that. And despite all of their best efforts in printing these happy, happy stock prices, with the help of some Trump tweets, always well-timed, you get that sense that there's something really dark lurking here as well, and that people are as unhappy and as anxious and as fearful and as polarized as they've ever been. And so that, to me, is the potential energy in this story, like two great static electricity sources, one positive, one negative, just sort of building. Hey, look how great everything is, and things aren't great. Do you feel that? I mean, you seem to be writing about that gap, and I'm wondering why you think that's there at all.
Well, God, that's so many layers to an onion there. I happened to just this morning catch a quick video of Adam Schiff getting yelled at by guys in the audience.
Yeah, that was
being
great.
Called a liar and stuff. Right. And these were not, you know, hipsters from Harvard, right? These were salt of the earth type guys, to put it bluntly. But that's a tactic that used to be like a year ago, or even 6 months ago, was a tactic, in my opinion, I'm going to upset some listeners, was a tactic of the left, right? Disrupt the speaker, you know, interrupt people at dinner, you know, stuff like that. I don't think the right was doing that. And I've been watching for it, and I'm sure that other people see it, and I don't. But now you see that. And we don't want to see that either at some level, right? I really hate Schiff. But that when that stuff starts happening – that's a bad sign, even if he's deserving, right? That's a very bad sign.
Mm-hmm. And what is that a sign of, do you think?
Well, it's a sign that people are angry, right? And it's a sign that, politics has gotten completely toxic. I was what I'd call Trump tolerant. So I sort of with a shaky hand pulled the lever for the Donald, in part because his platform was don't bomb the hell out of other countries. It's why I support Tulsi Gabbard. Don't bomb the hell out of other countries. Mm-hmm. And Trump has kind of been wavering on that. I think he's battling, you know, the deep state to try not to bomb other countries too much, right? That sort of thing. So I think in some sense, he's achieving what he set out to do, and that is, I think he's minimizing it. But there's some bad stuff right now. You know, you watch the war in Yemen, and it's just a mess. The further along I've got, the more I see him, and this is just going to freak out some of your listeners, but I see him as kind of this odd hero figure battling some very bad people. And he's such an unlikely package. He's like Columbo is to law enforcement or something. Mm-hmm. But I don't view Trump as the evil person. He's got his idiosyncrasies. He's got his flaws. He's got everything that I understand why people hate him. But the people he's battling, I really find to be much more dangerous.
Well, I think the title.
But I don't write about this, ironically. I don't write about this because it's a pandemonium out there.
I know. And it's we're really deep into the belief territory. You can tell because the emotions are so high. And, of course, facts and opinions don't really play well in that landscape. That, of course, I think has also been whipped up by the media, which is doing, I think, just when I look at it from a psyops, psych 101, like what they're doing to me seems really obviously designed to fracture and polarize people. And so what's interesting is, you know, you see the people show up with their pink hats and you see Antifa out there, like, you know, beating people up on the street at sort of the retail level. But you know what I haven't seen, Dave? Not once. I haven't seen one organized protest against healthcare costs and the fact that my premiums went up 22% this year and the healthcare CEOs are raking in 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, $70 million each on a yearly basis just for the CEO, add up the whole C-suite, who goes what the numbers are, right? It's obscene, it's perverse. And if the media chose, I think they could wipe up some righteous indignation over that travesty and racket, but they don't. And it feels rather coordinated to me on that front.
Yeah, well, I view the media somewhere on the edge of treasonous in many, many ways.
Yeah.
I think they're part of an insidious. I don't want people lying to me from either side, right? There's very few journalists that just seem to try to get it right. I've become a super Tucker Carlson fan. He, again, is a flawed character in many ways, but I've seen him go at sacred cows on both teams. And I used to hate him. So if somehow people think this is just some doctrine that I'm following, you know, some right wing thing that just follows me everywhere I go. I hated Carlson before, and so it was a real conversion for me. But I think the guy's amazing in many ways. And so he's one of the few guys who you can't predict which way he's going to go until he goes there. And I like that. Then there's things like the Fed is so unmoored. There's just so many things out there that are unmoored. The digital world is taking us to this digital gulag, in my opinion. I don't think I'm being hyperbolic. I think we're heading for very, very bad places.
And it's not any one thing, right? It's too much debt, and it's you know, ridiculous Fed policies, but. As well, lurking away on the other side is the fact, 80% of the insects are gone, and we don't know what's happening to all the fish in the ocean, but they seem to be getting, destroyed and on and on. So I have this theory that humans as an organism, we're evolutionarily designed to be reactive and sensitive to our environs, which makes a lot of sense, particularly for an adaptive species like ours. You got to know when it's time to go to the next valley if you've sort of played this one out. And there's nowhere to go. There's no next valley, and we're sort of playing this one out, and we don't really have a plan for that, except more of the same, which has gotten us to where we are. So I think that's at least part of the anxiety people are feeling, is this sense that maybe we're not all going to go to Mars after all.
Or none of us. And that also applies to the American Empire. A lot of people somehow think, American exceptionalism, which, by the way, was a Stalin term. American exceptionalism, we built an empire, but we had what at the time was unlimited capacity to move west. And so we had strong immigration programs because we could populate any amount of territory and not run out. And now we've hit California, right? And now you look at California, and it's like a tsunami of craziness building up at California, right? Everyone's piled up out there. They're doing insane stuff in California, in my opinion, politically and socially and we are now at the boundary of our expansion. Now, again, we still have a lot of acreage per capita compared to a lot of countries and stuff like that. But we're also the system's rotting, right? Socialism has totally invaded our thinking, right? We've got an entire generation of younger adults who think socialism's fine, right? I understand where it came from, but I also understand that it is a system that has failed without fail, right? I mean, it's failed every time.
Well, let me put my view in, which is I think we're already running socialism. It's just socialism for the 0.1%. That's all, right?
But so the 2020 elections is going to be, now it's my turn. Right. I wrote a lot about modern monetary theory because it's going to be about now you're going to print money for us. And I understand their anxiety. I've written hostily about bankers and central bankers and corruption. But the problem is, but that's going to cause more trouble, not less. That's the problem.
But I'm sympathetic to it. I agree that it's going to cause trouble, but I'm sympathetic to it because if you're a young person, you say, well, gosh, you've been printing up money and handing it out to Jamie Dimon. Why not us? Let's
right.
just put the fire hose this way instead of that way. It's our turn. I get it, right? And it's going to be
– I totally get it.
It's going to be
it'll
very
sell
hard.
So well.
Yeah.
It'll sell brilliantly. It'll sell brilliantly because there's truth, right? If Elizabeth Warren, by the way, had stayed on Let's Get the Bankers, she'd be the front runner, right?
Yep.
But so.
No, I agree with that. Now, before we go too much further, I got to return to the title, which is this year's year in review is Epstein Didn't Kill Himself. which I'm so enjoying the memes. Like, so this really broke through. I think this was a seminal thing because it broke through into the larger consciousness. So I go to all these social media sites like Reddit, and they're usually highly allergic in a very corporatized way to conspiracy theories. So if you go to like the subreddit for news or world news, you know, they just poo-poo and immediately shut down anything that smells like, you know, mentioning that, you know, kerosene can't melt steel or something like that, right? So,
right.
But this one broke through.
Yeah, I'm shocked by that, yeah.
Yeah, this one broke through. You now find this meme in all these clever ways of people of spelling out Epstein didn't kill himself, you know, in public and all of that. It really broke through because it was just completely obvious that he didn't kill himself, right?
Right, and, totally. I'm impossible, almost. Right.
Yeah. Well,
rounded to the nearest integer, zero.
Yeah. So, you know, my PhD, to do the little background on me, it's in pathology. So I do autopsies. We did some stuff. We did some forensic pathology. I can tell you that to break those three hyoid bones, you know, I went out and looked online and looked at all of the, you know, case reviews of that. Let me put it this way. If the police showed up and your wife was found with three broken bones in her neck, you're going to jail for strangulation, because 99.9% chance that's what happened. You know, it's just such a signature injury for strangulation, not a slump hanging off of a bedpost. It's just completely obvious.
And there is no bedpost in that cell. There is nothing to hang yourself from in that cell. I've read all about the various aspects of those, you know, safety cells. And there's no posts, there's no rails, there's nothing. There's your sheets tear, your clothes tear. You cannot kill yourself in one of those cells. There's no doorknob. There's no nothing.
Huh. So take us through it. You know.
Well, so here's the. Let me. So everything's wrong with the Epstein story, right? And I don't know where I when I write about it, it was the second topic I wrote about, and that's the hierarchical column way, and there's the obvious stuff that I think most people know. There's a bunch of pervs. Some people know that, you know, Epstein was hired by Bill Barr's father. Bill Barr's mm-hmm. father has intelligence connections, right? But people don't know that. Epstein supposedly went to Wall Street and with no bachelor's degree made $1 billion. Mm-hmm. And so you go, yeah, of course, that's pretty easy to do, right? No one on Wall Street knows him, right? No one knew him. No one could say, there's Epstein. It wasn't like Madoff. They knew Madoff, right? But mm-hmm. Where did Epstein get $1 billion, right? Well, it turns out he had one client, Leslie Wexner. And Wexner has all these intelligence ties. And so as you and I know, there's this woman named Whitney Webb who kind of pulled it all together, where it turns out Epstein has been an asset for intelligence, possibly multiple intelligence agencies, for his entire adult life. And he has, you know, Ghislaine Maxwell, who I tastelessly nicknamed Jizz, her father was Robert Maxwell, one of the most famous Israeli spies of all time. Right. Mm-hmm. And he fell off a yacht and died right in the middle of something that wasn't very tasteful. And so it turns out that Webb does this great job of connecting Epstein with this whole idea of the honey trap, the whole idea of compromising politicians and compromising people of power. But then what you do, and this is where Michael Krieger said something to me that made really sense, is that you don't blackmail them per se. You just give them more power. And so that you compromise them, but then you pull them into your fold, and then you say, and by the way, we're going to elevate you, and we're going to help you here, and we're going to help you there, and et cetera, et cetera. So where this all connects is that it turns out that the Mossad has a huge number of former Mossad agents populating Silicon Valley. It appears to me that Israel's remarkable tech industry, which well known that Israel is a great tech industry, that's probably sort of 100% intelligence, probably 100%, you know, national security. And so there's subroutines being wedged into various programs, stuff like that. But Ehud Barak is amazingly prominent in Silicon Valley. And so this whole story is a story about this web of international intrigue. After Epstein gets convicted of pedophilia, his exceedingly prominent associates like Prince Andrew and Barbara Walters and Stephanopoulos, all these people, Charlie Rose, they don't disown him, right? I mean, if you were a public figure and Epstein got convicted of pedophilia, you're saying to him, "Hey, Jeff, sorry, I can't be seen with you now." Right, you're toxic, and he was not, and they sealed up all the cases. How do you do that? And so every this is one of these stories where every single shred makes no sense. Now I'm going to disagree with one thing that you said, and that is, and I get to the end. I don't think he's dead. I think he's in witness protection because I don't think you could kill him. It's real simple, right? If he's been collecting dirt on powerful people and not getting assassinated himself, which means therefore he wasn't threatening them with it, right? You'd get killed if you're threatening people with it. And so he's got all the certain, and he's sitting in his cell and he's going to say, "Look, get me out of here alive or I release the hounds," right? That's how Daniel Ellsberg released the Pentagon Papers. That's what you do. It's called a suicide switch. And a guy who's been doing this for 40 years knows what a suicide switch is. And so if you wanted to off Epstein, you couldn't do it because you'd trigger a wave of shit flying across the globe.
Hmm.
And so you have to protect them. In fact, the most dangerous thing for them would be if Epstein got whacked by someone who wanted that release to occur. That would be the risky thing. And so I think they staged the whole thing. The high-eyed bone just keeps us chattering. They're happy to have us think someone off them, right? We throw it on the Clinton body count and laugh about it, right? That's nothing. They don't care about a offing Epstein in a cell. They care about revealing this massive web of connectivity that goes to the church, goes to the Beltway, goes to Silicon Valley, goes to Israel, goes to everywhere. This is a web of people of power and influence, and it's massive. I think it's the biggest scandal in history, and they are furiously trying to put it away.
And even
Prince Andrew's interview, even Prince Andrew's interview makes no sense.
That was such a disaster.
So why would he
do
that?
Sweat. What was that? I don't even understand what
he was. I think he had to take one for the team, but I don't know how that fits into the plot. There's no logic in it. So until you can see logic in doing that interview, you don't understand.
Well, here's how I know just how dirty this whole thing is. It wasn't until I think 2 months after he had allegedly killed himself, or a month after, that the FBI finally raided his island. You know. Which was just sitting there for the whole world to know about, right? And that they, as far as I know, they still haven't gone to his New Mexico ranch, right? So, you know, in what world, when you are, you know, you have child porn all over the place. And by the way, thank you, media, for making me so mad at you again, because the media was always with this underaged women thing. Yeah, we have another name for that, you know, child rape, right?
Kids, right?
Underage women. God, NPR did that. New York Times
did
that.
I call it an adult petting zoo is what I call it.
It's awful. But the FBI wasn't investigating.
I love this line. I put in this line where I said, you know, I have to make fun of it because it's so sad. But I said, I have the Ted. I said, "Boss, deplane. And then the Ricardo Montalban guy responds, "Yes, unshackle the girls." And then there's stuff like how do you seal up a civil case in which the women in the civil case are saying this guy raped me?
Mm-hmm.
Now I know for a fact that the judge in that case is by law required to pass that to the authorities.
Right.
And they didn't. They sealed it. And it was, you know, it was this secretary of what? What was the cost of the secretary? It was a cabinet member with Trump.
Yeah,
Secretary of Education. It was something like that, though. Labor, yeah. And then he retires. He says, "Okay, I'm out of here."
Yep.
And he had admitted that he sealed the case because Epstein was intelligence. And where's Ghislaine Maxwell, right? Why isn't she being interrogated? Why isn't Dershowitz under the hot lamp?
Yeah.
Because one of the women in the transcript said Dershowitz. She pointed right at Dershowitz.
Yeah. and Bill Clinton, or
and no one's challenging any of them.
100 other people who should all be.
And
you know, if this was at your and my pay grade down here, you know, the FBI would be having us hauled up and putting us down under oath and taking statements, right?
They're never going to do it.
Yeah. So that's why I think this is such importance, because it now broke into the public awareness to the point where people are getting, oh my gosh, there's two sets of rules in play here, obviously. And of course we saw, you know, we always know that justice is a two-tiered system, but it's now becoming more obvious and it's really starting to grate on people more and more, right? So
let me point out one thing. I'm not going to divulge it. And mm-hmm. I don't know if you got to that part yet or not, but, the question then is, well, then who is the dead guy in the gurney? And I'm going to make your readers read it.
Okay.
The dead guy in the gurney. There's a theory of who he is that's so funny. You will wet yourself when you read it.
All right. I'm going to go hunt that down as soon as we're done here, because I'm super interested in that. I did see the pictures of him allegedly being wheeled out on the gurney, and somehow the nose and the ears don't quite line up. And all I could think
was... Yeah, well, there's a guy whose nose and ears do line up, and you're just going to wet yourself when you see who that is. And he died three weeks earlier. Cause unknown.
Oh, okay. Well,
you can search it. You have to search...
I had to go through this crazy sort of thing of like, well, maybe he died and, you know, fell on his face and his nose and his ears got smushed. I was like, I couldn't make sense of it because they don't line up with him, if that's a real picture anyway. All right. Well, speaking of this two-tiered thing, you were writing on gold manipulation. You wrote that, quote, two employees were put on leave while Jamie Dimon was not. Nothing ever happens. A prosecutor closed a 5-year silver manipulation case abruptly. 5 days later, he was in private practice defending the very same JPM Metals manipulators, end quote. I mean, this is just, it's just so blatantly in your face that, it's a corrupt system at this point in time. And so you spent some time sort of chronicling all of it, but it's almost too much to keep up with at this point. It really is.
Well, so that again, within finance, I think I'm going to return to the financial topics when stuff starts happening. And when the system starts breaking again, then it's going to be pandemonium. Right now, all I can do is write about things that just look wrong. And I can write about things that look incredibly risky. And I can write about how we're at world record awfulness in so many ways. But the average person looks at their 401k and says, look, I'm up 20% this year. Right? Mm-hmm. So I just said, look, go read last year's. It's gotten worse. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah, it is just getting worse and worse. And of course, some of that's just sort of bubble dynamics. And, I can't figure out when the plug is going to get pulled on all this. I, for one, think that the Fed is just absolutely freaking out. I'd like to turn now to the whole idea of what's going on with this repo madness. And I think the best explanation I've heard so far just came out recently from Martin Armstrong. And he said, look, nobody actually really has a clue what's going on here right now. We just know something's not quite right. All you need to know when the repo market's blowing out is that the four big banks in control of most of it aren't interested in lending to other parties even overnight. That means trust is broken. We don't know what it is in the cheap seats yet, but to me, the Fed is obviously panicking and either lying about it or being ignorant about it. Either way, I don't feel comfortable with any of that stuff. What do you think's going on there?
Well, I wrote a lot about it. I listed all the theories that I've been able to collect over the year, and I put out an APB on Twitter, and I got all sorts of highly authoritative answers that vary all the way from a zero hedge conspiracy theory to Hillary to Donald to Jamie Dimon shaking down Powell. There's just a gazillion things. I still think the best theory, and it's the one that I opened with and then had everyone tell me I was an idiot, is that the banking system is an emergent system, which means it basically has a mind of its own. And it once in a while, it just goes crazy, right? It's like, you know, when the fish all of a sudden wash up on shore by the hundreds of thousands. No one knows why that happens, right? And so every once in a while, the banking system just has a coronary. And I think in this case, it's not just the banking system. It's the shadow banking system. I think you're right. I think Powell's terrified. And And if he's not, then he really is an idiot. But I'm suspecting he's terrified. And they keep trying to normalize truly extraordinary behavior. And so this smacks of a tremor, right? Mm-hmm. This smacks of you know, sort of San Andreas fault stuff. And they're trying to fiercely put it away. They're trying to find a way to calm it down. But you know, if it's metastable, it's just a matter of time. Right. And they say the banking system's stable. They say the banking system's in much better shape because of Dodd-Frank, blah, 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 blah. I go, okay, right now, 39%, according to Gundlach, 39% of corporate debt is junk. Now, I'm not sure he's saying it's rated junk, but he says it's garbage. And you got the leveraged loan market. But 39% of corporate debt is junk. And when that junk goes bidless, how's the banking system going to be doing?
Well, there's that, and there's all the Covlite and leverage loans, which don't give them a lot of protection.
Yeah, it's all crap. I mean, it's just super crap. It's super garbage.
Yep, and we had the BIS last year come out and say, hey, not for nothing, maybe you should pay attention, but 1 in 8 companies is a zombie, meaning they can't, their operational cash flows don't even cover the interest payments, so they have to keep tapping that endless credit market, you know, to keep the bid going. And so that's what I think the Fed is trying to do here, is just make sure that the credit markets are always amply supplied, but the longer they do that, the more junk piles up. And so we haven't had a brush fire. And I think we're facing an Australian crown fire at this point, you know, if anything does get started, and they don't want anything to get started, so everything has to keep going up. It's just such a ridiculous system.
Why do you think the BIS is so honest? The BIS seems to be the only source of non-Pinocchio-like pronouncements. It's a fascinating question because they're kind of the bank of banks, right? They're kind of at the top of the food chain. They should be, in some sense, the dark lords, right? But they come out and say stuff, and you go, whoa, that should scare people, right?
I agree. I agree. Some of the best papers I've read came out of the BIS, including, you know, one that said that talked about openly the ways in which banks, central banks, can hide their tracks so that they can more effectively manipulate currencies because blah, 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 using proxy agents. Like, they laid the whole thing out. Like, you know, these are the things we've studied that work well. And so I'm thinking if you know, the central banks a decade ago were using proxy agents such as JP Morgan et al. To go out and manipulate currency markets, what other markets would you think are off limits to central banks who decide that they, as a small unelected cabal of people, know best what the prices of stocks ought to be, gold, currencies, I mean, everything. I mean, I think they feel like they're responsible for setting the prices of everything without studying history and discovering that price setting is not usually an optimal way to go.
Right. It's the way the Soviets tried, right? The Soviets set prices, right? And the Fed thinks they're in charge of setting prices. The Soviets actually were trying to cheat because what they were doing is setting their prices, watching U.S. prices and saying, okay, we'll just covertly just set our potato rates at the same as the U.S. and therefore we can kind of fake it. And not recognizing that, well, maybe potatoes in Russia aren't the same price, right? And maybe the supply demand curve's different. So it didn't work, right? But now you have the central bank. They think they're in charge of climate change. They think they're in charge of they think they're in charge of Brexit. They think they're in charge. And then you got that wacky Bill Dudley memo that he wrote, a former head of the New York Fed, right? Writes an op-ed in the New York Times saying that to the extent that the president is a risk to the economy, it's the Fed's jurisdiction to worry about who's president. Right? that was extraordinary. And then the Wall Street Journal came out and wrote this op-ed and said, holy cow, this guy's trying to tell us that the Fed is politically independent. And then Dudley writes that. The Wall Street Journal was absolutely unambiguous in their shock that Dudley would write that. And then Dudley backed up. He says, this is not about the deep state. It's just my opinion. There's no cabal. And I'm going, dude, thou doth protest too much, right? So the question is, why did he do it? Why did he do it? Why did Mark Carney talk about the dollar losing reserve currency status? Why did Dudley talk about throwing the president? What is going on? Because they don't, you know, it's not like Dudley muttered it on stage like Japo did. Dudley edited an op-ed.
Yeah, which was vetted, you're sure, up and down the chain
right.
of command.
And the question is, you say the Fed's job is to make sure we have the right president? What a stunning op-ed from a former New York Fed president. 2018, he's not some doddering old fool. Well, he might be an old fool, but he 2018 was when he stepped down.
Yeah.
This is fresh stuff.
Yeah, no, it's clear the Fed's wildly political, obviously, and they've whenever that nose of the camel went under the proverbial tent, the Fed has been getting more and more and more active and interventionist, and sort of I get the sense that they feel like they're in charge of everything. They're responsible for setting all prices and that they know what they should be higher, usually. And they've been absolutely immune. So I'm on this one-man campaign on Twitter to try and, you know, bash the Fed. And I know I have a little bit of quite a few fellow travelers on that.
But for me, at least two, man.
at least two, right? But here's what, I mean, why does not one journalist say, Mr. Powell, your policies are directly fostering a wealth gap. Right now, five people have as much wealth as half the world. We're wondering, where's the line? Where do you stop? Is it when those five people own 100% of everything?
It.
No, how can they? They you're not allowed to deny something. That's like Ted Bundy denying what he was up to. You can't. You know, the evidence is there. It's plain as day. You print money and you shovel it into the markets and it goes, you might as well wire it directly into the 0.1% bank accounts, right? You might as well. So he's responsible for that. And why does nobody ask him the most simple of questions, which is you are playing with social fire here. You are burning people. You are a redistributive organization. You don't create wealth, but you do print up purchasing power, which means it came from somewhere. Where did that come from? Oh, everybody else. And you handed it to who? These guys.
Here's what would happen. You know what would happen. First of all, he would never expose himself to a real interrogation, right? It would all be orchestrated. If he was ever, for example, giving a speech somewhere and they had a, you know, let's take questions, which I don't think he would ever do. But if someone said that, he would then give an answer that was some canned answer like, you know, we've got lowest unemployment, the little guy's been helped by Fed policy. You know what they'd say.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then you would not get the mic back.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, that would be the final word. That's the problem. You need a scenario where he says it, and then you come back and you say, no, you're full of crap for these three reasons. Please clarify. And he won't expose himself to that.
And if you were a journalist and you asked that question, of course, you would never be invited back and you'd be out.
Exactly.
You'd be out.
Access journalism is the problem.
Yeah. Yeah, remember it was Janet Yellen who canned, I think it was Pedro DaCosta, just canned him because he dared to ask a question about some insider junk that was not cool, where an outside firm was getting early intelligence from the Fed, and he tried to corner Janet Yellen with that, and she just turned away from being that kind grandmotherly persona into an iron lady all of a sudden. That was it. He was out. Done.
So I ran a free Pedro Twitter campaign that day. I'm so mad at that. And I set up a free, and I kept all day long, I just venomous tweets, free Pedro, blah, 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 you skanks. You know, I just uncorked. Yep. I was so mad. And then that night I got an email from Pedro and he said, you know, that was really meaningful to me. I appreciate you doing that. And so, but he's now not asking Fed questions, right? He lost his job.
Yeah.
He quit, I think. Because he got – so what happened was after that was the Free Pedro campaign was when the next Fed meeting occurred, the head of the Wall Street Journal, the editor of the Wall Street Journal walked into Pedro's office and says, you're not going. And Pedro said, why? And he said, you're not going. And so the Wall Street Journal got told DaCosta's not allowed. And that's when I did the Free Pedro. He then set into motion, I think that day – to quit. And I think he's at the Peterson Institute or something now, but he was so mad. And in any event, yeah. And I mean, he's not even the most militant, but you can't do that, right? You're now challenging the elite power structure. You're challenging the people who the one thing they all agree is they all want to be powerful still. They want to retain their power. They want to be elite. By the way, here's a thought on the retaining eliteness. I do not want to talk about impeachment with the exception of one thing. To me, the smoking gun in the impeachment trial was Sondland.
Was what?
And the reason that Sondland in the morning gave a speech that basically said Trump and all his buddies are all guilty as guilty can be. If you listen to that speech, I heard it. I was driving somewhere. I was on a trip or something. And I heard it and I go, wow, that guy just nailed Trump. And then in the afternoon on cross-examination, he said, I don't know anything. I didn't hear anything. I didn't see anything. I just presumed it. The guy was lying. The guy was lying either in the morning or at night, right, in the afternoon. There's no chance that that same person gave those two. So if you were a CNN person, you heard him hammer Trump. If you were a Fox person, you heard him declare that he knows nothing. And it was the same guy. And I'm going, how is that possible? And then I realize, here's the smoking gun. He gave the two sides their talking points. And so the Democrats could say blah, blah, blah. The Republicans could say blah, blah, blah. And neither is talking about him committing perjury. They mm-hmm. each got their talking points. And the reason is because they all agree, whether it's Schiff or whether it's Jordan, they want to be reelected.
Yeah.
And they got their talking points. There's no way Sondland's testimony makes sense by a normal model. I think he gave of the two sides. It's like the Mueller report, right? The Mueller report came out and said not guilty, then put this stuff in. And so both sides screamed about how they won. Mueller report had it's like, you know, the classic, you'll be lucky to get this person to work for you line, right? Mueller handed both teams something to talk about.
Yeah, what a travesty that report that was, though. And I mean, 2.5 years to find nothing.
I think he found nothing. I think the report generally came to the conclusion that there was nothing there. And now, you know, this Horowitz report and stuff. So, you know, Trump is anti-fragile. Every time they attack him and they don't bring him down, he gets stronger. So if you're a Trump hater, this should bother you to no end. Because he is like the guy with the glowing eyes in Star Trek, right? He is getting stronger and stronger every time they fail to bring him down.
Well, I'm a little bit shocked that the so-called deep state. So you got Clapper, Brennan, all those people. They're just openly lying about stuff.
Comey.
And then nothing happens. You remember it was under Brennan, I think, that, you know, the CIA even got caught like hacking into Senate staffers' laptops. I mean, domestic spying, worst of the worst. He lied about it in front of an open committee. And then later it turned out that he had been lying and nothing happened. He's still an eminent person. And I have to watch him on CNN from time to time. And it's astonishing to me the level of brazen rule-breaking, law-breaking criminality that can exist at that level with nothing, no consequences.
So here's what's happening. So if you go to the conclusion of my annual write-up, I go super dark.
All right, let's go.
I go through all of this, even though I didn't write about it all, because I talk about the digital gulags that they're setting up. You know, I'm really bothered. You know, someone like Milo Yiannopoulos, who's a hateable guy. I find him fascinating, but I understand why people hate him. I understand certainly why the left hates him profoundly, but they've been able to erase him. So this guy was able to find microphones everywhere. They have erased him from the public forum. They took him off Twitter. They took him off Facebook. They took him off everything because they didn't want him there anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And they took off Gavin McInnes, who, by the way, was nowhere near as polarizing as he was made out to be. He's gone. He got vaporized. You know, when they boot Roger Stone, he's hateable from both sides, in my opinion. But you can't boot them, right? The next person they'll boot will be you.
Mm-hmm.
Because they'll say, but your opinions are not worthy. I got in that thing where they booted my YouTube. I did a QTR podcast. And they YouTube booted it. Now, I didn't give a damn. It's like, so what?
Well, you had many feathers in your cap this year, and I think getting banned off of YouTube, that's one of them.
Oh, that was great, wasn't it? But they're a bunch of Nazis. And by the way, YouTube's changing, and I don't think people have noticed. YouTube has these new rules. It says, you know, the little guys, if they're not earning enough money, we can boot them, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know what that means? It's corporate now. It's not – the word you no longer matters. The word you is gone. So I know there's videos that used to be on YouTube. If you search them, you can't find them. What you can find are news stories that have the video in them, but they're corporate news stories. And so YouTube is no longer about you. This is an encroaching Stalinism. I really don't think I'm being hyperbolic here.
And it's just corporatism. It's corporatism, too.
Now, I don't think it's just that, though, because this is speech now.
Yeah.
We talk through digital, right? We communicate through digital. We don't write letters to the editor anymore. We go to Facebook. We go to YouTube. We go to Twitter. And the fact that they can through the years, right, Standard Oil, Exxon, U.S. Steel, you know, all the major industries, they were powerful, right? They mm-hmm. built an empire, but they were powerful. Never did I feel like they controlled me. And these new companies control me. It's not that they know everything about me. I've long since given up on that.
You're right, me too.
They control me. Here's a story that I tell. In China, and if it's in China now, don't think it's not going to make it here. In China, they're talking to a couple of expats, and they're saying, tell us about life in China. They go, it's really normal, blah, blah, blah. And then one guy says, well, you know, because of all the cameras and facial recognition, the other day I crossed the road, and by the time I stepped on the curb, I got a text message that said, you just jaywalked. We've deducted this much from your bank account.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to live in that world.
Yep.
That's I don't want to live in a world where if you do 31 and a 30, you get deducted from your bank account. I don't want to live in a world where they can catch you doing anything, right? We're all married, right? We've got someone watching over our shoulder enough. We don't need a digital overseer, overlord. I want to have to get caught. I don't want Volvo's putting out a car that monitors your driving. If that perceives your driving as distracted, they alert the authorities. I will never buy a Volvo if that's the case. But then the other cars will do it. This is beta testing.
Yeah.
This is horrifying to me. We give up civil liberties one at a time. Cash, right? They want to get rid of cash. I did a Kaiser report the other day, and I was unaware of this. He says Michael Hudson thinks they're going to take NERP. They're going to take negative interest rates to, before this is done, negative 25%. I said it will be a cataclysm if they take interest rates to negative 25%. Right? That will be – and what's happening in the world right now? Violence is trending. That's the problem. Violence is trending. How many countries in the world are there violent protests, right? Dozens.
Mm-hmm.
Hong Kong's getting the press, but Portland, Oregon is always flaring up. The yellow vests in France, this is first world, not third world.
Yep.
Violence is trending. At some point, the people say, now I've had enough. And once it starts, how do you stop it? Not only is currency fiat, but government is fiat. The government declares they are in charge until the people say, oh, no, you're not. And then they've got a problem.
Yeah. And they're really, one of my little quips yesterday on Twitter was I said, if Band-Aids could cure cancer, I'd be totally behind what the Fed's up to. Right. We have these structural issues that papering over with another $500 trillion of liquidity before year end just can't address, you know. And this is the part that I think is leading to so much of the stress. And some of it we can just look. This always happens in all of the ancient religious texts. They had this concept of a jubilee. And if they had debt-based systems where, you know, there was interest involved, they understood that over time, compounding systems get away from you. So what was a jubilee? It was seven periods of seven. That's 49 years. And that's about how long it takes before a compounding system really gets away from you. And here we are approaching nearly the 50th year of coming off the gold standard. It's been a fun ride, but look what's happened, right? We are now entrenched in a system where we are compounding our debts at more than twice the rate of income growth, even on a nominal basis, let alone real. There's nothing you can do about that except to keep lowering rates. So you get to zero and then you have to get stupid and say, well, maybe we just go into negative territory as if that would use a linear extrapolation of what we've been up to. But everything goes wonky in negative territory because it doesn't make sense. Because fundamentally it says the productive output of your excess surplus has a negative value. Right? What? What kind of
right.
How do
right.
you make sense of that? I don't even know what to do with that kind
of
a statement.
Yeah, time is of negative value too, right? So time is of negative value. Why would I lend someone money to get less back? By the way, there's a guy named Mike Green explained who's buying all the negative interest rate bonds, and it clicked. And I said, "Who's buying those things, right?" And it turns out that these bond funds are set up just like equity funds, where they're sort of market cap weighted.
Mm-hmm.
And so, to the extent the equity funds, the FANGs just get bigger and bigger and bigger proportion, because the higher their price, the bigger their market cap, the more money gets dumped into those shares. And so you get this virtuous cycle up, which will become a vicious cycle down. The bond funds do the same thing. And so apparently, as the bonds, you know, approach zero and the price of the bond goes up, apparently, once you cross zero, it goes bananas.
So, yeah, these negative interest rates are just insane. And that was a really big story coming in through the middle of last year. Seems to have come back a little bit. But, I mean, yeah, we're still talking $10 trillion in negative yielding interest rates. So I want to get to the conclusion of all this, though, because I do believe in this fourth turning aspect. And I think where you went is where my mind and heart has gone, which is to say, it's going to get darker before it gets better. And that's just trend extrapolation for me, because the people I have to confess, I have lost friends or former friends who have taken on emotional views that I just can't follow. And I see this gap getting wider and wider and wider between the various parties. And in my mind, I now actually begin to understand something that I was reading this article by this colonel whose job was to foment civil wars and insurrections in various countries. You know, welcome to the empire. At any rate, they have this whole model and they characterized it and they said, look, there's 8 things that we would do or that you would need to see before you could reliably, you know, get some sort of a civil war started or an insurrection going. And he said his concern was he saw that the United States had 6 out of that 8. And I think with this new polarization we're seeing, I think we're up to 7. So I'm beginning to understand, you know, I think we already have an intellectual civil war, but I'm beginning to understand how sides can become so entrenched and separate in their views that there really is no reconciliation available until some sort of catharsis. Is that where you were sort of heading with all this?
Yeah. You know, when you're watching a video and some guys are beating the tar out of Antifa, and you're rooting for them, you realize that you've jumped on the train, right? And so, you know, as I was watching the guys scream at Schiff, which on the one hand I was highly sympathetic to, I was more alert to this, and I said, you know, Dave, if you're rooting for these guys, then you're kind of rooting for this armed insurrection approach to life, and I think we're going there, and it will not work well, right? It never does.
Mm-hmm.
Revolutions never work out for the little guy. They're always sold to you as you know, we the proletariat, we the people are going to take back our government, and then guess what? You just hand it to a dictator. It never works well, except with the exception of things like the American Revolution, where we were shaking off shackles from across the pond. But civil wars don't work out well at all, right?
Right.
And so.
Well,
that's where my brain is headed, totally.
Yeah, and there's really no resolution, I don't think, to the sort of financial mess we've gotten ourselves into, or the fiscal mess, or the monetary mess. You know, and all of these things just feel like what we did. Here's my larger view. Look, we right around 1913 is when we came up with this brilliant idea that we could just sort of like, hey, we'll just do this really, really entrenched, this fractional reserve thing. It's right about the time oil was coming online. And then it all worked magically, but correlation is not causation. And it just happened to be that we were coincidentally going into deeper and deeper into debt as we had more and more of this tasty, tasty fuel to do things with. It was a lot of fun. But now that that's sort of nosed over, and by the way, conventional oil peaked years ago, and we're replacing it with this ultra expensive stuff that, by the way, doesn't pencil out economically. You know, every shale company I follow is losing money and has already burned $250 billion. It is not coming back out of the ground. We can throw more money in holes in the ground, but that's a different story. So now we're at this awkward part of the story where we have this entire entrenched system of constant exponential growth of money and credit and claims. And we don't have a system that can accommodate that in the real world. So it's really a human-derived fantasy model, which is fun because it gets to entrench power, and you know it's great. And the reality of the world, which is, oh, we're, you know, it just can't support that level of growth anymore. combined with the idea that China and India together are coming online to bring forward a billion middle-class people to more than eclipse the entire middle classes of both Europe and the United States, and their demand on resources, that's the story I really see as shaping up coming forward. And nobody knows how to make sense of that. And, you know, the status quo is just busy trying to pretend as if, you know, we can just persist. That to me is the conflict. Our narrative doesn't work anymore. Just doesn't work.
Well, I saw some crazy stat. I'm going to make it up. This is not true, but it was something like if the country of, we'll call it country X, produced no CO2. Let's use CO2 as a proxy for economics, right? Mm-hmm. And to the extent that energy burns the economy, you burn energy to grow the economy. That country X, if it put out no CO2, that would be the equivalent of what China puts out in 10 minutes. Some crazy stat like that. And so the tragedy of the commons is taking place on a gargantuan scale, mm-hmm. as India and China do what we are attempting to, for better or for worse, whether logical or not, reverse.
Well, this has been one of my chief critiques about the climate change movement is that, you know, I read these articles that say, you know, we need to be zero carbon by 2030 or 2050.
Right.
And I just pencil that out and I say, cool, just tell me which half of the people you think should die because we can't feed them.
Yeah.
Right.
Or 90%. Right.
Or 90% or, you know, which are, you know, how many. Which 9 out of 10 jobs should go away? I mean, it's just the idea that we'll just sort of comport ourselves by other means because we've decided that we should be able to use wind towers still misses the fact that if you watch a wind tower getting put up and you see the 100,000 pounds of concrete and steel go into the base and then you see the giant tower go up and the nacelle and all the blades, there's fossil fuels in every single one of those components just dripping off.
Can you get that back or not? From a wind tower, is it energy negative no matter what?
I don't know because we have no closed loop system that says we entirely use the energy from a wind tower to mine and produce all the components. My guess
so
is
no one's
probably
been able
not.
To bean count that one?
Well, even if you bean count it, I don't know how you would actually. So it's just such a hyper complex interconnected system. Like, where do you draw the lines in that study, right? Like
the trucks shipping the stuff and everything, right? Exactly.
Yeah, the sandwich that the trucker ate, where'd that sandwich come from? You know, how about the roads that they drove on? What were those made out of?
So for your listener, I put in 32 pages into climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not qualified to evaluate climate change, right? You have to be wildly broadly read, and you have to be incredibly smart and diverse and a polymath and everything else under the sun, and then spend 10,000 hours. But what I've tried to do is to adjudicate it like a judge would adjudicate a case where they're not really qualified either, but they just listen to the two sides argue and then say, okay, here's my decision. And the climate change story is a very complex one. One thing what I can guarantee you is that you're being lied to in a profound way in the climate change story. There's just there's so much fibbing, so much politics. There's so many things. There's so many vested interests. It's not just Exxon. There's vested interests everywhere. $600 billion is being put per year into climate change. $600 billion if you bean counted across all the different stuff. And so hypothetically, let's say climate change turns out to be a dud, right? I don't doubt that your model, which by the way, we first met years and years ago, but we first started communicating. You were probably a third of the way through the crash course. I remember you were going, geez, you know, I'm going to listen to this. I go, I think they will. But I'm a big resource depletion hawk and things like that. I totally agree with everything you say about the pollution and the plastics. We don't need to pack everything in plastic. What kind of garbagey mm-hmm. protocol is that? Everything comes in plastic, you know, but I don't think the climate's going to be our problem. That's my conclusion. And if climate change is a dud, here's the problem. Here's the biggest conflict of interest of them all. If it's a dud, that $600 billion goes poof, right? That $600 billion, departments on campuses, agencies and governments, subsidies for various kinds of energy, which I support – various kinds of energy. I love the tech. I love the stuff for Facebook. And I support doing all that. But the push goes poof if climate change turns out to be a dud. What are the odds climate change is going to be a dud by that model? The answer is zero. They're not going to let $600 billion go poof. It's too important. And so they're going to lie their ass off. And here, as a scientist, and you're a scientist too, as a scientist, I watch the arguments. And I watch for emotional arguments. I watch for database arguments. I watch for plots that are rigging data and plots that are cherry picking start points and stuff like that. It appears to me that the climate change crowd are the frauds. I'm the deniers. I'm not picking up the lies out of the deniers. I'm not picking up the conflicts out of the deniers at all. And I spent a lot of time. And I could be wrong. I haven't read a lot of the primary papers, right? All I've done is looked at the arguments as though it were a Harvard debate club, right? But the specious arguments are coming out of the changers. The ones where I can point to and say, that's crap right there. That's crap.
Yeah.
And I read plots for a living, right? My day is staring at plots.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to tease information out of them. And when I see one, I go, oh, man, that is just a chart crime right there.
Yeah, well, you're a scientist. I'm a scientist. So we've spent a lot of time looking at these things. And we understand that scientists are people and that cherry-picking data is very easy to do. And confirmation bias is a thing. And so as a scientist, I'm more skeptical of science than most people, I think. Right. Particularly,
me too. Yeah.
Particularly yeah. In areas where I know there's vested interest. So you want to get me started on something like any sort of like healthcare study. You know, I'm just immediately suspicious. Like, oh, you know, we analyzed 17,000 kids and discovered that there's no negative correlation to screen time. You know, put your kids on screens.
I know.
Right? I was like, I need to know who funded that study.
It is so easy to screw up one of those studies, too. And polls, my God, polls. Oh, my God, are they corruptible and things like that. So, here's the thing that's so frustrating to me is you can reach a point where you believe nobody.
I know.
You literally believe nobody.
Yep.
And Daniel Ellsberg warned Kissinger of that. When Kissinger was about to get top security clearance, Ellsberg said, Henry, you're about to see stuff that's going to amaze you. You're going to be elated. And then you're going to be talking to some guy who thinks he knows what he's talking about, but he doesn't know what you know. And then you're going to realize that he is wrong because he doesn't know what you know. And then you're going to stop listening to people, and then you're going to be a bonehead.
That's pretty smart. I like that.
And I'm afraid of reaching a point where someone will say, well, here's a study. I go, I don't believe it.
Yeah.
Right? And that's a dangerous place too. But I'm getting close to that. The whole climate thing is so – I've never seen such a profound conflict of interest. And it's not Exxon, right? It's not – Exxon doesn't need to be conflicted because you and I both know that they're going to sell whatever oil they can get out of the ground, right?
Yeah.
They're not going to not be able to hawk oil. They're not – wind power is not going to compete with Exxon. They're not afraid of hydroelectric. They're not afraid of geothermal because they know they're the best game in town by a mile as long as – by the way, I read Exxon's 1980 – here's one for you.
Yeah, I read that
too. I read Exxon's – the 1982 report on climate change?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you pick up the one line that was important in there where they mentioned that in the worst-case scenario – so I thought it was a brilliant report. I thought it was incredibly scholarly, balanced. And they're saying, oh, this is evidence Exxon knew that climate change was a problem. I go, no, they were evaluating the published literature, publicly published literature, and trying to figure out what it all means.
Mm-hmm.
But there was one line in it that caught my attention. I'm going, oh, this is a Chris Martinson moment here. They said, in the worst case scenario, the CO2 problem could become a problem before resource depletion.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going, I think that's the first time I've seen a big oil company refer to the running out of resource.
Yeah.
You probably have heard it. You probably have heard it because you know these guys.
Yeah. So I was I served on this UN panel for a while, and there was a gentleman there who was a former president of U.S. Shell. And it was a couple of years ago when peak oil was dead. Peak oil's dead. You know, the media's just drumming that up. Oh, my God.
Fracking our way to
prosperity. So I talk with this guy. I'm like, hey, what do you think about peak oil? He goes, oh, it's totally real. We're in the business of looking for oil. Trust me, we know exactly how hard it is to find, and we've scoured every inch of the globe. And there's a few basins where we think there's a little left over in Africa and maybe down in South America, but it's pretty well punched through, right? So for somebody who's in the biz, there's no question about what's happening, none whatsoever. If you're in the business of finding it,
you don't go to the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico to get oil if it's easy to get, right? Bottom line.
Yep.
You're squeezing the last drops out of a sponge, right? And boy, this is a long time back when it was all about Hubbard's Peak and Matt Simmons, and boy, that seems like an eternity ago that Peak Oil was actually getting the attention. Now it's calm because they found a way to frack us back into oil. And as you've said a million times, the fracking wells don't last and the fields are getting drained. Now, is it possible that there's shale type oil all over the planet that we haven't discovered? Is it possible that stuff exists?
Yeah, and
different price.
We know about a few of those basins, right? And there's the Vaca Muerta in Argentina, looks pretty good. Russia's got a pretty big play that looks pretty good. So it's there. China.
But it's not unexplored, is the point.
No.
They've been identified, in your opinion.
Pretty good sense of it at this point in time, but, you know, we'll probably find some more. I still think Africa is probably the last big prize because I don't think it's been sort of picked over the way every other place has. I mean, Africa's huge, right? It's like basically the size of all the other continents you care about in one, you know. And so
50 years from now, what's happening? Have we somehow bridged to some energy, or are we going to be living in a smaller footprint?
I'm going with smaller footprint on this one because, it's the amount of energy it would take to develop ourselves. So here's Dave Dillon. Here's where I would suddenly become hopeful instead of pretty cynical. If suddenly, our government came out and said, hey, look, we got a lot of oil because, we can still frack some more, but it's not infinite. We think there's X quantity. We need X minus Y to just build out towards this new future, and that's what we're using it for. So, this new future is going to be more local, more electrified, yada, yada. Probably looks a little bit like Europe with their green belts and cities and all that stuff, right? Or whatever. But at least there's a plan to say, we think it's going to take an allotment of energy to build a new thing, a new system, and we use it for that. And then the rest of it, go ahead, put it in your F-150 and take your kid an hour away to soccer practice, right? Have at it. But this allotment over here is for getting us into this new future. But we're not doing that.
Yeah, so you use the seed corn to plant seeds.
Yeah. Yeah, and so there'll be...
So can we do this? Can we transition without hitting the nukes? We can't.
I don't know.
I think we got to do the nukes. And the problem is, as I see it for us, the local boys, is that we're not going to hit the nukes fast.
Yeah.
And China, places like that, are.
Well, if we could get the thorium reactors going, I'd be even more hopeful. China and India are working on it pretty hard. That seems like a pretty decent fuel cycle. I've investigated that a bunch in the Lifter reactors. There is something there. But again, you'd have to get started on it right now. So here's my prediction for the United States. We're not going to get started on anything. We're going to pretend like we can just keep driving our F-150s and Tahoes and all that other stuff. And then there is a crisis, right, somehow. And we all go, oh, gosh, now we're short on energy. But guess what? That's a bad time to start trying to make your plans, right? Because at that moment...
Yeah, that's Easter Island right there. Wait a minute, we cut down the last tree.
Yeah, at that moment, you have this towering pile of debt, which was all predicated on an infinite future, and suddenly that's revealed as a fantasy. And so your entire financial system goes into disarray, which means, I think, coming up with a giant capital-intensive, very technologically interwoven build project that's larger than anything we've ever undertaken, that's a crisis is a bad time to sort of envision and execute something like that. That's how I look at it.
I totally agree. But the problem is we're so close to a financial crisis now that we may be way, way, way past the fail-safe on – we don't have $50 trillion left in us, in my opinion, to do this without doing some serious damage to the dollar and to the economy and all sorts of stuff. I just don't see it. I think we've got all these unfunded liabilities that we have to pay or face the consequences of. And they're enormous. They're fantastically enormous. So the pensions are all underfunded. at the top of a bubble, and the Social Security is a disaster, and we promised so much medical help for everyone that's now profoundly expensive. By the way, you know who's making a fortune in this medical thing? You mentioned it. I've been trying to find out where all the money's bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
And I've made the argument, I think on your podcast before, that if you actually look at pharma, they're profitable, but collectively the big ones, you can't find unseemly profits. You mm-hmm. find good, healthy profits. The insurance companies are going nuts. The insurance
yep.
companies are printing money.
Yep.
They have found a way to make the higher healthcare costs even more profitable.
Yeah, I know. They're really disgusting, immoral, shameful people. And I'm hoping for the public humiliations to start at some point in the future, because it's really awful what they're doing. Just awful.
Good luck with that one.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I know.
A boy can
I
hope.
Know.
So, well, what do you see, in the closing moments here? So you went dark at the end. You think this gets a little worse before it gets better. But what are you actually seeing in the next few years coming forward?
Well, at some point we're going to have a recession. And then we're going to find out if Dave is right or wrong on his economic forecasting, because I'm sort of in the John Hussman club of overvaluation and overextended, and I see all these guys who say, yeah, but we're gonna blow off top, you got to stay invested. And I go, I don't care about that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you tell me that in 5 years we're gonna have buildings burning to the ground economically, I'm happy to step aside now. And they're kind of talking that way now. The blow off top lingo is a way of saying stay invested, don't jump out, because this is where you're going to make a lot of money. I go, yeah, that's I'm not buying that model. I think we're going to end up in the next recession whenever it comes, and it's way overdue in my opinion. We're going to find out where the dead bodies are buried.
Everywhere.
And then the question is, if it's a generic recession, I'm wrong. And I think it's going to be a mean one. I think it's going to be an awful one. And I think that people are going to be mad. It's going to have social unrest associated with it, because guys are going to go, I lost my job again, and now you're asking me to bail out the banks again? How is this possible, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what they're going to try to do. And we're not – there was some farmer who said, quit talking down to us. We're smarter than you think. And that's correct. That is, our collective wisdom is unbelievable. You know, we're reading this year about how the Syrian chlorine gas attacks were a fraud. I wrote about that last year. Twitter totally debunked them, right? The populace knows this stuff now. You can't miss this stuff if you're paying attention. And now all of a sudden it's like – and we knew that Comey and these guys had lied their asses off. The Horowitz report's not a shock to me, not a shock to you.
Nope.
Right? We knew they were lying. And at some point, Joe Sixpack says, that's it. I've had enough. And I don't know what happens. I keep thinking you're going to tell me, because you are so much more sort of up to speed on this social, societal stuff. But
wow.
I can't picture how it's sort of like a person with, stage 4 liver cancer. I go, well, what next? I go, you're going to die, right? And you can't wrap your brain around it.
Well, here's the thing. You mentioned a government by fiat, and it's by the consent of the governed. And of course, we've been fairly willing with our consent for a long time, but that can break mm-hmm. quickly, like that school of fish
totally.
Turning left. And then we have a system of money by fiat, and it's really a faith-based system, and credit really operates on trust. Well, we don't have – that's what we're taught. That's the general theme here to me, is this loss of trust.
Right.
And it's the erosion of that institutional trust. In fact, it's worse than that. People now trust that the healthcare executives are going to be greedy, shameful pigs who are going to do everything they can to screw them, right or wrong. Right? We know that. And we
right.
know that –
Right. And the media is letting us down. That's the thing that's got
yeah.
me bothered the most. The media is letting us down completely. And that bothers me to no end, because they're kind of the sheriffs on the beat.
Yep.
Right. They're supposed to be out there watching and writing about this and doing their Woodward and Bernstein thing. And there are some good ones like Cheryl Atkinson. There are some good, but there's some that are just so bad. And this is where Trump is correct when he attacks the media. Now, the people hate Trump. Again, I get it. But the media is awful. And they're constitutionally protected. They don't deserve the protections. get them on the bench, bring someone off the bench, and give them a shot. Here, by the way, you know, some guy, the Starbucks, you want greed? The Starbucks CEO just got offered a $50 million bonus if his shares 3 years from now have beat 80% of the S&P, irrespective of whether they're up or down. And here's the offer I'd make. I'd find some smart potential CEO, and I'd say, here's the deal. We'll give you a job. You work for free. And if Starbucks has reached these metrics, which have nothing to do with share price, the share price is cancer to the system. You give the CEO the chance to say, you're going to work for free for 3 years. And if you get these metrics of real wealth creation to this level, you get to keep the job. But you're going to work for free till then. And there'd be people who would say, deal, I'll take it, I'll take it, I'll take it. You don't have to give a guy a huge salary and a $50 billion bonus. Some people would just love that job.
I would love that job.
Well, I would hate it, actually, because I'd be so incompetent. But there's people who take it and say, yeah, great. I don't need money. I need a company. I want to run a company. Right? So the reason he's getting a $50 million bonus, regardless of what the share price does, as long as he beats the other guy, think how much corruption that's going to create. Think how much the insider crap and the buybacks and stuff that he's going to do because he's got a $50 million bogey he's going to hit, and he will rig it till he hits it. There's no chance he cares about the shareholders long term. He'll get the share price. That's not long term. Someone's going to get screwed if you pump the price up. We know that's true. I want a person who runs companies well. I don't want a person who just focuses on share price. Share price is a false indicator.
Mm-hmm. Well, and as we've seen, you know, the reason I think this is going to be a barn burner of a recession, because it's not really a recession. A recession is a business cycle. This is a credit cycle that's going to burn itself out. And when credit cycles end, it's like lights out, right? All those C-suite decisions were like, how many shares are we going to buy back? Well, they just decide that afternoon, no more, right? And, you know, all sorts of things that were sort of running flawlessly and forward just grind miserably into reverse, you know? And, right. You know, it's really fast. That was my learning from the last two bubbles. You know, when Pets.com closes its doors down, it happens pretty much overnight and everybody's fired, right? It's really fast. Whereas in a normal recession, you know, the business cycle starts to turn and Ford says, well, maybe we've got a little bit too much inventory. It just takes months to sort of wind things down and mothball stuff and make painful firing decisions. But when your credit runs out and you're a zombie company, it lights out that next day. You know, it's over, right?
Yeah, so 10% of the S&P, 14% are said to be zombies. 14, that's a James Grant number. 14% of those major companies are said to be zombies, meaning their cash flow doesn't pay the interest on their debt. Those are going to be auctioned off on the courthouse steps when we hit the next. And as you point out, when credit cycles end, you end up in you know, I'm not afraid of deflation. I am afraid of a deflationary collapse.
You're right. Me too.
Right? Deflation is fine. If we had let deflation do its thing, we'd be in great shape. But no, we don't. But a deflationary collapse is a disaster, right? That's Great Depression 2.0.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we're not tough like we were in the 30s.
No, but I, you know what? I know some people are trying to get tough because they see it coming. So it's kind of a, right. there is a little bit of a movement out there amongst at least the people I hang with to become more resilient and get in shape and learn how to grow a few things in your garden because we might need those skills back here on this next one. So I'm just, my summary is a pox on both houses and shame on the institutions that are failing us so badly, be it the Fed or the media. But that's really on us, you know. Those are self-inflicted wounds at this point in time. And so, you know, I guess I'm okay if those chips have to fall where they're going to have to. And it's just, you know, hopefully it's not too bad. My fear is that it is too bad and that, you know, it once things really begin to correct and go into collapse of financial system, that's where politicians bring out their worst sides. They blame China. They say it was Russia. They just make crap up. And next thing you know, there's missiles flying, to speak of a different sort of a nuke. I'm really worried about that possible outcome because Because, listen, the DNC had a chance to say, wow, we put up probably the single worst person in the universe, and they actually lost to Donald Trump. We need to look in the mirror and not do that again. And instead,
and they're talking about bringing her back.
And instead, God, please. And instead, they said, oh, it must have been Russia, and came up with this whole thing that was easily debunked by people with a functioning computer inside of minutes. And somehow, you know, that evaded the entire superstructure of commentators and journalists. And it's just a mystery to me. Anyway, if we lack the ability to have even that level of introspection around these things, I'm not too positive for how we're going to respond when the next crisis starts.
No, I totally agree. And so I think that's what the Fed sees. So if I'm going to give them credit, by the way, watch out. This is a totally a tangential thing, but the world hasn't picked up on this one. There was a model put out by the St. Louis Fed for a change in various reserve habits, and what the Fed proposed to do was to let banks sell non-reserve assets to the Fed at will. And that would encourage them to keep their reserves to a minimum. And it was put forth by this guy named David Andolfato, who I was actually supposed to debate, and then he bailed on me and he unfollowed me on Twitter. Apparently, he didn't like the fact that I've been hammering the Fed relentlessly. But what they're trying to do is they're trying to give the banks the power to do QE at will.
Uh-huh.
And it's got no press. It's the Andolfato trig model. It's got no press. Now, he got mad at me when he was saying, look, what they'll do is they'll sell their treasuries. They'll take their excess reserves and they'll buy treasuries. Now, I think the model was that would allow them to then unwind the Fed balance sheet, right? Because their excess reserves would be used to buy the treasuries and the Fed could keep selling into the marketplace. But I said, but David, what they're going to do is they're not going to buy treasuries. These excess reserves are just going to use to leverage up elsewhere, and they will become non-excess by statute. They will become – they don't lend reserves. They lend against reserves. When you have excess reserves, you have excess lending capacity, and they will do that instead. You're going to lever up the system. He got mad. But watch for that, because I think they're going to have QE on demand is what I would call that model. And I wrote quite a bit about that. And it got no press. It got no press that I can see. But I think it's coming.
Well, it's we're going to try more and more crazy things, anything, right, to keep this whole thing sort of going. And, of course, without a plan, a master plan that says, hey, if we do keep this all going, here's how it resolves. Here's where growth returns. Here's when we finally pay stuff down, because it's never a good time to pay stuff down during the expansion. Hey, why should we? And then when the correction comes, hey, now's a terrible time. It's always a bad time. So you just keep pushing this further and further. But eventually, you know, the big math problem here is people go, oh, $300 trillion of extant debt plus four times that in unfunded liabilities. And all of those only make sense if we can have a future that's larger than the present. Well, how do you get a larger future? Oh, you got to burn more oil. You got to make more cars. You got to build more houses. It takes resources. So sooner or later, people go, oh, we don't even have the resources to make this square the circle in this story. And that's just so painfully obvious to me. I don't know why it isn't even.
So I quoted you when you said, and I think it was not too long ago, actually, where you said we've doubled our global oil consumption since the 1990s. How many more doublings do we have left? And that's exactly right. To the extent that doubling the oil consumption is not only a proxy for doubling the economy, but it's a mandate for doubling the economy, right?
Right.
You burn oil to grow your economy. You can't keep doubling, right? I go all the way back to the original crash course where you had a puddle in the infield in the stadium that fills the infield by noon, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can't keep doubling. The exponential function, the Albert Bartlett moment, it doesn't work. And that's that was the great insight of the crash course, is nothing that's exponential is sustainable.
Right. Well, thank you for that. And listen, we're out of time. Let's do this again soon.
Okay.
We got a lot more to talk about. This has been an absolutely fascinating romp. And thank you so much for, of course, taking the time. It's a real public service, I think, writing your year in review. And this one's a doozy.
Well,
it's really good. And I think people actually really need to spend some time with it and to think through not just what are the implications if this fourth turning comes, as it seems to be coming, and what are the social implications of that, but also what are their responses to that going to be? How are they going to personally, you know, what actions you can take? Nothing? Something? And so there's a lot here to chew on, a lot to consider, and it's funny too. So thanks for making it many moments of levity in their great quotes. It's perfect. So
you're
really
welcome, and thank you for having me.
All right, Dave, until next time, people, you can find the year in review, of course, at Peak Prosperity, and we'll have the link right at the bottom of this podcast. So take it, read it over a couple of mornings, and let's have a great conversation about it at the site. Dave, thanks again.
You bet. Thank you.